Hello, and welcome to the Business of Information Security podcast with me, Gareth Becker. In this podcast, we chat to senior cybersecurity executives from a range of industries about their passions, experiences, and challenges. Without further ado, let's go ahead and dive straight into today's episode.
Welcome to the Business of Information Security podcast. I'm here with Mark Osborne, and we are recording live at CISO London. It's the first time we've had an in-person event for some time, so we're all very excited to be here, and I'm very pleased to have you with me, Mark.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to actually be at an in-person conference again. It's like being let out.
Indeed. I thought I'd start by just by asking you to introduce yourself a little bit and what you're up to.
Well, I'm Mark Osborne. I have done a number of CISO roles for various size companies. I'm now working at an exciting new credit card company called Yaya Finance, which is all cloud. As I like to say, no bricks, all clicks.
Nice. That's almost like a buzzword there.
Yes, it is. It's, yeah, I think I'll patent it.
Yes, it could be the next big thing. And in fact, it gets us on to the theme of this of our talk today, which is about zero trust. And you're speaking later on today in one of the sessions on this subject. And I know from our conversations before that, you know, you're kind of sensitive to these kinds of buzzwords, a certain kind of spin, marketing talk, that kind of thing. So what I'd like to try and do is just try and dive into this subject and see if we can separate out the spin from the value. So how do you see that?
Well, it's quite simple. Quite often in the security industry, we're victims of a marketing machine. They generate a demand for things that we didn't know we needed, and it turns out eventually that we don't need them. Zero Trust Network is a little bit different. I see it as a bucket of essential technologies that the marketing people have got hold of and put a fancy name on it. So there's going to be three possible reactions. You're either going to just walk away from it, say, yet another buzzword. You're going to recognize for what it is a set of useful technologies and processes. Or you're just going to say, buy it because I don't need it, and it'll become shelfware. And there's a surprising amount of CISOs and security teams that have got more money than good sense and will buy a product and swap it out within a couple of years because they don't actually identify the need and they're hoping to avoid doing the hard work. Well, in some cases, Zero Trust will do that. If you get a good product, or two good products in my case, you can actually develop a good paradigm of security based on basic principles. The old AAA, authentication, authorization, and auditing. And although that's not the way the vendors would like you to do, to look at it, that's actually what it does for you. So if I go back to my CCIE and my Cisco security days, that was a key component of all the security devices and all the exams I sat. It is fundamental. It is not a generated demand. It is absolutely foundational. If you can't authenticate your devices and you can't authenticate your users and you can't set up a trust there, you don't have a security paradigm. And if you're like me, cloud native, I don't have an internal network. It's essential. So it's something that I live every day, and I'm aware of some of the shortfalls and some of the great positives.
Mm. And you touched on it there, but zero trust, at least as a term, has been around for some time. But it does seem to be more in the minds and on the lips of people now, and of course the marketing focus we mentioned before. But is there something also in the market, in what's going on in the industry and with businesses more generally now, that is making it relevant now?
I think so. I mean, many businesses are making more money from their digital channels, and you value what makes you more money if you buy into the capitalist paradigm, and most of us do. You know, we're there to make money. So there's more focus on protecting that. The COVID situation, that made it clear. Many of the larger traditional organizations were unprepared for a mobile workforce. They relied on the internal network and therefore suffered because their devices, their workforces weren't secure outside the perimeter. In a zero trust situation, inside or outside makes no difference as long as you configure it right. And I must emphasize that nothing is for free. You know, let's break this paradigm where we just go out and buy products and then buy another one next year in the hope that it fixes it. You know, it's people, processes, then technology. And lastly, everyone's scared of phishing. Everyone's scared of ransomware. Ransomware has been most effective where resources are publicly available. Most of them, you know, some of the ransomwares have had sort of little password crackers built into them. But they're not extensive. And if you have good authentication and good trust policies, you'll be fine. And people know that. That's why they're buying Zero Trust.
Yeah. And you may have mentioned one or two of them there, but if we look at Zero Trust as kind of a bucket, I think you described it as, what else is in that bucket? What are some of the core principles?
Well, yeah, again, you see, you're falling into my trap there, you see. I mean, I don't think there is much more than authentication and authorization. Those are absolutely key to security. So they're not the only things, but, you know, I don't like them referred to as the what else, if you see what I mean. They're absolutely the basis. And they're audit tests as well. You know, nobody's going to go through an audit without people saying who's got access to your key payroll server and who's not left. And Zero Trust, a good product, will help that. The other things are, I think, that makes implementing MFA very easy. These days, everyone needs two-factor or multi-factor authentication. Many of our products use a diverse range, but if you trust your Zero Trust, you can secure numerous applications. So there's 2MFA, there's single sign-on. If you buy the right product, you will be able to secure all your cloud services and all your internal services with either one or two Zero Trust products. Some of them provide containment. Although Mist refers to containment, I don't think that's why I buy it, because I have, as a no bricks, only clicks organization, I don't have anything to contain. It's all out in the cloud. It's naturally dispersed and it's naturally contained. But if you're securing a legacy organization, there may be a simple route there for you. You may have central policy management. Many of these products are very good at combining all these things.
Yeah. So in terms of the implementation, and certainly thinking about teams, potentially about people, you know, there's the kind of, maybe it's a truism that the more obstacles or the more restrictions you put on the way people do their jobs, the more they may look for ways around it or not engage with what you're trying to do. Is there a danger with that with Zero Trust? How would you kind of approach a rollout?
I think there's a danger of that with everything. But I think actually Zero Trust is designed to make it easier. It's one of those technologies that's designed to make it easier for you to sign on. Passwords are easy to remember, easy to hack, and so everyone knows now that we're moving away from that. So this means this basically introduced single sign-on to the organization, probably for the majority of their portfolio, inside and outside, so it makes it easier to the users. But again, that's the jeopardy. Many of these Zero Trust products have remember this device. When you click that, you deprecate your security. It might not make the security completely nullified, but the whole idea is that you authenticate once on this device, and that will stop you authenticating on all the other servers, because you've set up a verified trust based on tickets and established protocols.
Yeah. And do you think that, I mean, I think in the situation that you're in, you mentioned, you know, very cloud-based, and a lot of businesses are going through this digital transformation, doing more online, you know, that or in the cloud, I should say. And you have a lot of organizations that are somewhere in the middle. Maybe they've got legacy, they've got some cloud. Does that pose a problem? How would you approach that kind of situation?
To be honest, it shouldn't make that much difference. You will still have the effort of securing the cloud appropriately and securing the internal network. What you may have, referred to it earlier, is you may have a jeopardy that you're looking for this product to solve the problem of poor internal security, i.e. many internal servers are public. Well, they're not really public. They're just either the business didn't know who should be using them and the IT department didn't know who should be using them. So it's perfectly safe because it's behind the firewall. Now, we know that's not true. So you'll probably have to deal with that as part of your implementation plan. So, again, that's one thing on the list. Nothing comes for free. You're going to have to do some work. But the likelihood is, day one, you'll probably have better security once you've installed a Zero Trust tool or tools on your network than you did before. But you've still got some work to defining the trusts, defining the policies in there. Some of the new tools have extra things, like something that I find immensely important is privileged identity management. It seems such a shame to buy a product that manages identities when it can't manage administrative identities. So look for something there. Or if you can see the product that you bought, like currently I've got, has the potential to it, badger the hell out of the manufacturer and say, look, this is 5 lines of code to give me what I need. And hopefully they'll do a field enhancement for you and you'll save on some of these extremely expensive privilege management systems.
Mm. And is there anything that you think, there's a lot of different things that sometimes get lumped in a way or put into that bucket. Is there anything that you think with the conversation around Zero Trust that shouldn't be there or that doesn't belong there?
I have seen some odd things lumped into it. I tend to ignore it. One thing that's mentioned quite a lot, and I'm not going to disclaim it because it's actually in the NIST, I think it's NIST 207 paper on what a Zero Trust architecture should look like. They have some behavioural aspects. Now, that sounds well and good, and it's used in things like capture and things like that. But personally, I'd rather use user behavioural analytics in some EDR or MDR than actually confuse the issue by trying to, authentication, authorization. I like to be immutable. They either are or they aren't. You know, sometimes on a wet Wednesday because you look like a jolly nice chap, I think in practice it's going to be very hard to prove in court when you're doing a forensic investigation. You know, well, why did this product suddenly decide to give the payroll access? You know, I don't want that complexity. It seems like a nice to have, but something that I personally would rather not have.
Yeah. So just to sum up, if you were to give some advice to a cybersecurity executive who's been, maybe they've been pitched, they've read a lot about Zero Trust, but they're really looking to get down to the core of it, how would you advise them to do that?
It's a technology that's worth looking at. If you've had an audit report that criticized on the the number of disabled users or the number of redundant users on your system if you're well aware that you can access access components that you shouldn't have access. If you've had issues with ransomware, it could help you a long way. It's a useful tool, and if you're going to be a hybrid environment, frankly, I think you probably need it. And who isn't a hybrid environment in these days?
Quite.
But yeah, and I think that the one of the pitfalls you always get is the quick fix syndrome, in my opinion. And if you've tried single sign-on and failed, don't try to do the same thing with zero trust software. You need to look why your single sign-on failed and move from there.
Great. Well, thanks very much. I appreciate the time today. And thanks very much for joining me.
It's always a pleasure to talk at someone. Thank you very much, Gareth.
No problem.
Thanks again to Mark Osborne, CISO at Yaya Finance, for joining me for that interview, recorded live at CISO London 2021. And now I have two rapid insight interviews conducted at CISO London with my colleague Catherine King, with Jonathan Craven, Privacy and Compliance Lead, UK for iRhythm Technologies, and Naveed Islam, CISO at PaymentSense. Looking at how you can keep your staff motivated with a security mindset when working from home, and how to get buy-in from those all-important stakeholders for information security initiatives.
Jonathan, great to chat with you today. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Really nice to be here.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to guess as someone in the audience who's perhaps just started out in this kind of senior role as where you are, and they're thinking, oh, Jonathan, I'd love to be able to have those frank conversations, but how do I build the relationship where I can have that very honest conversation? What are you looking to do to build those champions? How do you foster that relationship? How do you get that buy-in from those stakeholders?
I think primarily it's about education and awareness raising. It's about raising the understanding around data protection, privacy, cybersecurity with every member of staff, and not just keeping it as the sole remit of the cybersecurity team or data protection team or whoever. I think it's about normalizing it, socializing it, making sure that everybody has an understanding, but also probably a little bit myth busting, because I think there is a lot of fear around it. And I think that's certainly a lot of the knee-jerk objections I see to these kind of conversations is often comes from a place of anxiety and uncertainty. So really it's about raising people's understanding and awareness of these, so that these issues are a thing that we need to deal with, but B, also providing them some reassurance and saying, actually, if we think about these things up front and we put control measures in place, then they're going to be less of a problem going forward. And we can actually embrace new technologies, new ways of processing, like AI, for example, in a safe, managed way.
Absolutely. Now, going forwards, we were talking there about kind of the leadership looking up. How about looking towards the grassroots level, your people who are in the thick of it? How are you continuing their security education, especially in the context that I'm guessing there's still going to be some folk working from home? There's going to be some kind of in this hybrid limbo situation. How are you looking to continue that discussion?
I mean, there are a number of vendors who have products on the market which are probably adapting more to what I describe as a drip feed awareness raising approach, because I think like a lot of traditional approaches to training and awareness raising, doing a one-off annual piece of training is not really fit for purpose any longer. And certainly when we talk about the cybersecurity and data protection environment changing so quickly, the training and awareness raising about that needs to keep pace. So actually, a lot of these new products are looking at providing sort of bite-sized information, and they're almost sort of an overlay onto your staff sort of desktop, where regardless of where they're working, so even if they are working at home, working remotely, whatever, that they will keep getting these little bit of drip feed information, which will constantly reinforce positive behaviors, but also raise their awareness about risks.
Now, Jonathan, I'm not going to take too much more of your time, so I'll let you get back to the session. Thank you for speaking with me today.
Thanks very much. Be nice to be here.
Naveed, great for you to join us here today. Now, when I wrote to you and I said we could talk about anything, you were very keen to talk about people. Now, we know that people are the crux of success, failure, everything in an organization. And I want to know from you, how are you dealing with the challenge around having a diverse talent pool within your organization for InfoSec?
Firstly, thank you for having me here. So I think it's my third event, in-person event since lockdown, so it's still a novelty. Look, as a background, I joined Payment Sense about 9 months ago. We are a very relatively young organization, 12 years. We're about, 900,000 strong, diverse pool, very young company, young, hip, talent density, so a lot of clever people who are very good at what they do, which poses... It's not so much a challenge. As I said, it comes back to... The reason I'm really passionate about this is because people... It's often said in security, people are the weakness or the greatest weakness. They're not. People are essentially the lifeblood of an organization. And in any organization, people are doing what they're best at. So finance people do what they're best at. Finance people team do what they do. Product teams do what they do, right? As a security, we often talk about technology and how do we basically stop this, stop that, etc. But the enablement piece is really big for me. How do we enable these people to do what they need to do in the time that they need to do it? Speed is a massive piece for us. Agility, speed. So it's getting to speaking to these people, understanding how they work, understanding the culture of the organization. So culture of the teams, the organizations, to be able to say, how do we basically make security an enabler? My favorite analogy at the moment is a Formula One car. Formula One car has safety built into the car. It doesn't slow the car down. It only slows the car down when the client is slowing down, i.e. when the driver hits the brakes. It's not just slowed down just for the sake of it. So this is why in a diverse organization with talented people, you need to understand, you need to appeal to what's going to make them tick rather than go, security is more important than what you're doing, because to them it's not, and it will never be. The other thing the lockdown has enabled, maybe the wrong word, but has resulted in, is a blurring in lines of work and home life. People, there is no such difference now. People are using the same devices for work and for personal. So it then becomes, how do you make it appeal to that person, that team, that function around the right behaviors, being online, regardless of whether they're at work or they're at home? Because their personal data they need to protect as much as the personal data of our customers. So that's kind of some of the challenges around this and how we're trying to deal with this, to make it context-based and embed it into the ways of working as opposed to consider security as a standalone piece.
To me, it seems like the InfoSec community are now having to really think about their employees and clients and customers very holistically. It's no longer that person as an employee, it's that person as a person. And as you mentioned there about that personal use of the device and then jumping onto their emails to be their professional self, that is still the same person and same device as you mentioned. Exactly. So crucial. Now, I am keen to understand from you the security change in culture that you've noticed. You mentioned there about using the same devices, being at home, those boundaries being blurred. But have there been anything else that stuck out to you as a cultural shift that you're having to shift with as well?
The shift has actually come from the threat perspective. So as and when people March, April 2020, whenever it was, where essentially everything locked down, people were at home, people's behaviors changed, not just from a work perspective, right? So you still had your laptop and you were logging into your Gmail or your Office 365 and you were doing whatever you were doing. But at the same time, people's personal behaviors changed, which was around online shopping. So what did the fraudsters do? A lot of it came around, actually, there was two things. COVID was raised topical. So there were COVID-related scams. And then there was a lot of online delivery type scams because the world moved to an online model. So it was addressing that, actually was a trend. Rather, nothing really changed from a work perspective, especially in our organization, because we're cloud first. Everything is in the cloud. So as long as you have a laptop and internet, people have access. But the biggest change from a daily user perspective was around what the threats became, which was because everyone's behavior changed. There was no physically going to shops. There was no interacting with people. Everything was online. The fraudsters took advantage of that, to making people aware of what that meant, which meant actually security's job almost changed from what you need to do at work or for work purposes to how do you just protect yourself.
Yeah, so like I mentioned, just very holistic in that very view much. And I think what can be funny is whenever you talk about IT or InfoSec or even data, you can have a view of what that leader might look like, but actually increasingly I think it requires a very people-y person. You've got to be able to go down and talk to people, understand their challenges, understand what home life is like for them. Are there, you know, I've spoken to several executives in their organizations who are even extending the education to their children and saying, if you're homeschooling, these are the things you need to be thinking about. And it's really, really holistic, family-based viewing. And I think that's actually quite a healthy thing and something perhaps we should have been doing earlier on as well.
We should have been. But one of the things, we just trialed a password manager internally. And the feedback generally was, for work, people didn't see as much need for it because we have things like single sign-on. Where they really got interested is when they found out there were, say, free licenses to use for personal use, for the family. And that's where they essentially swung the deal. For me, I don't really mind in what scenario they use it. Because if they're using it for personal life, let's be honest, that's going to bleed into their work life, so, right? We should have been doing this a long time ago. Companies are frowned upon work from home because of risk of this and that. What it's actually enabled is you just have to think outside the box. And as I said, the biggest thing for me has become now, there is no difference between work and personal life. It's securing the person. I've even stopped against securing the device. I don't talk about securing the device because it has very much IT connotation, technology connotation. We're trying to secure or make the person have a secure lifestyle in a digital age.
Naveed. So. Naveed, thank you so much. I'll let you get back to your sessions.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed that episode of the Business of InfoSec podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you're currently listening to make sure you get our latest episodes. Plus, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please consider leaving us a review. As always, you can find us and engage with us on social media, as well as on the Business of InfoSec website, where you can find this podcast, as well as other topical articles, reports, and videos. So, until next time, take care.